I'm ready. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Is my Rex Stott inquirer here? If not, I'll ask again tomorrow. I'd like to try to pick up the thread, if I may, of where I ended on Tuesday night. I ended by introducing the subgenre of the police procedural or police novel, especially as these developed in the United States. But not all policemen and policewomen speak in American accents. Indeed, some of the very best do not even speak in English. Perhaps more than any other crime fiction subgenre, the police novel has taken root in foreign soil, where it has flourished and grown and diversified in fascinating ways. Indeed, one of the best known of all fictional policemen, Jules Maigret, first made his appearance in the 1930s, and he continued to solve crimes into the 1960s. Georges Simenon is one of the 20th century's most prolific authors, and his 75 Maigret novels must be numbered amongst a total of 450 books. Because they were written so early, the Maigret series are sometimes claimed as the first police procedurals. But although we learn a certain amount about how the Parisian gendarmerie work, the novels are almost entirely focused on their laconic, pipe-smoking, wine-drinking figure. A very credible character, not equipped with immense powers of deduction, but with a fundamentally intuitive intelligence. Another European detective appeared in just 10 novels, one a year from 1965 to 1975. This was Detective Inspector Martin Beck of the Homicide Squad in Stockholm, Sweden. These are police procedurals. Over the sequence, we get to know Beck and his colleagues, the bright ones, the dullards, the hard workers, and the lazy, and we observe them carrying out real, hard slog, credible police work. Each of his cases is marked by routine, slog work, false trails, dead ends, as well as by moments of breakthrough and success. It's a remarkable series in many ways. Firstly, the books were co-authored by a couple, and their names, because they're so difficult to spell, are on the board, Mai Sirwald and Per Valu. Lovely account of how they worked. Every evening, one of them would put the kids to bed and do the washing up. The other one would sit down in front of a typewriter and bash away. And then they wrote alternate chapters. Every book has 30 chapters, and he wrote 15 and she wrote 15 in every single one of them. This sounds a rather mechanical procedure, but they must rank as one of the most successful collaborations in crime fiction. Ian Rankin has judged the pair, quote, one of the truly great writing teams of world literature. Second thing to notice is that Sirwald and Boileau were left-wing journalists, and they consciously set out to write crime fiction which delivered social and political critique. They were writing to entertain, Sirwald recalls, I'm quoting, but our intention was also to describe and criticize certain changes in our society and in the politics of that decade. She's still alive. Her partner, before he died in 1975, put it more forcefully. We wanted to use the crime novel as a scalpel cutting open the belly of the so-called welfare state, unquote. And so, in those books, time and again, a particular crime raises larger moral and especially political issues, insisting that marginal groups in Sweden, immigrants, women, the poor, despite the rhetoric of the welfare state, are exploited and bullied by the state and by big business. In the hands of this pair, the Swedish pair, the police novel provides a progressive, even a radical critique. And this is significant because the police procedural generally, and especially in America, delivered a very different ideological message. In America especially, the police procedural was a powerful weapon of reassurance. It was something that helped reassure that in the prevailing social order, readers should take consolation from the fact that even the anonymity of the city and the vastness of modern industrial life provides no defense against law and order. Thirdly, third thing to note about this couple is that their combination, social critique and police inquiry, with flawed, human, credible central characters, has been extremely influential in what has become a prolific tradition of Scandinavian crime writers. Today's Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and Iceland loom large on the modern crime fiction map. There's one of those factoids out there on the internet, and I think that's all it is, which claims that there are more murder novels published in Scandinavia every year than murders take place. Be that as it may, writers like Henning Mankell, Joe Nesbø, Stig Larsson, and Arnaldur Indridason all in interviews have acknowledged a direct descent from Sjöwall and Valu. They also influence crime writers outside Scandinavia. Ian Rankin's Inspector Rebus and Martin Cruz Smith's Arkady Renko, for example, both amongst my favorites, have much in common with Martin Beck. Rankin, the writer, is also an heir to the Swedish pair in his approach to writing crime fiction. He has pointed out, and I think it's a very interesting point, that the police detective, I'm quoting, has open access to all layers of society, from the oligarchs to the dispossessed. Rankin wanted, he explained, to raise questions about the state we're in, and quote, I reckoned a cop could act as my surrogate, with that ability to move up and down social hierarchy. And so the hard-drinking Detective Inspector John Rebus explores not only the Edinburgh underworld, but also issues such as racism, trafficking, corrupt local government, and environmental damage. These are gripping crime thrillers and social documents of their time. At its strongest, says Peter Messant, a British academic who's written about the police novel, the police novel has mutated into an ongoing inquiry into the state of the nation, its power structures, and its social concerns. And he argues that in the police novel thus conceptualized, authors focus on individual police officers, on how state power is exercised, and on the state of health of the society in which the novels are set. And in tomorrow night's lecture, I'm going to use that triple focus, the police, the social system, and the society, to consider contemporary South African crime fiction. But today, I'm examining a series of eight crime novels written by James, his friends all called him Jim, James McClure, published between 1971 and 1991. They are all set in Trekkersburg, known outside these books as Pietermaritzburg, and very faithfully, very lovingly reconstructed 1960s Maritzburg. They feature an Afrikaner police lieutenant, Tromp or Trompie Kramer, and his colleague, Detective Sergeant Mickey Zondi, a Zulu. I'd like to introduce this pair to you and convey something of how they and the novels work. And then I'll go on to look a little bit more closely at how McClure's novels are positioned in terms of politics, critique, and history. McClure was born in South Africa to Scottish parents. He grew up in Maritzburg, where he worked as a photographer, a teacher, and then became a journalist, reporting on both the Magistrates Court and the Supreme Court. Quote, "This brought me for the first time into regular contact with the South African police, and a fascination began to grow based on so many paradoxes," he said later. But in 1965, that's 6 years before the first of the books is published, aged only 26, McClure left South Africa and settled in Britain. So although Peter Maritzburg provided the setting for these novels, it was a city and a country recollected rather than experienced. The first Cramer and Zondi book, The Steam Pig, remains one of my own favourites. On display are features of McClure's writing that run throughout the series, a pacey storyline, tightly plotted, with an unexpected solution to the murder being investigated, a sharply observed gallery of minor characters, some of his walk-on parts are quite memorable, a light, rather gentle, satirical tone, and some laugh-out-loud moments. The book opens in the backroom mortuary of a funeral parlour, where the undertaker is taking a somewhat unhealthy and prurient enjoyment in the naked corpse of a beautiful young woman. Under her ash-blonde hair, I'm quoting, are a pert nose and alert, unplucked eyebrows, a good-humoured mouth and a perfectly proportioned body, not a mark or a blemish anywhere, unquote. Thus, we, the reader, first encounter Teresa LaRue. It soon emerges that she's in fact, although her own doctor put her down as cardiac failure, it soon emerges that she's the victim of a murder. She's been stabbed in the left armpit by a sharpened bicycle spoke. A few pages later, we encounter the police for the first time, and we meet Tromp Cramer. This is how chapter 2 opens. A suspect in the next room screamed, not continuously, but irregular intervals, which made concentration difficult. Then the typewriter unaccountably jammed. The report was not going to be finished on time. Colonel Duplessis had stipulated 4 o'clock, and it was already 3:55 with at least a page to go. "So you can bloody well stick it, Colonel, sir," Lieutenant Tromp Cramer declared loudly. He was quite alone in the murder squad office, unquote. I think this is typical of McClure's economy of effort and his distinctive oblique irony. Without any authorial comment, there's no author judgment being exercised, but we learn that the Trekkersburg police are forcibly extracting a confession, and that this is routine, a distraction like the jammed typewriter, so that Cramer does not give it a second thought. We also learn at the very outset that Cramer is not constrained by the rank and hierarchy so crucial to his profession. The hell with official channels, he decides a few pages later. And as we get to know him better, we learn that Cramer is an effective policeman, dogged, resourceful, and cunning. But we also discover that he is all the more effective, far more effective, as a member of a two-man team. In this book, as in all the others, the crucial insights come from his partner, Zondi. This is how the reader meets Zondi for the first time. Cramer has fallen asleep on a divan in the murdered woman's room. Quote, "The face above him was black. His right fist heaved up. Mist flopped back. He knew that laugh. He had heard it where children played, where women wept, where men died. Always the same depth of detached amusement." Cramer closed his eyes without troubling to focus them and felt curiously content. Bounty Detective Sergeant Mickey Zondi sat himself primly at the dressing table. Then he opened the larger manila envelope and shook out its contents, a batch of photographs and two laboratory reports. As a child at a mission school in Zululand, he had adapted to making do without his own textbooks. He read fast, read once, and remembered. Again, there's a lot packed into these laconic sentences. The two men, we already learn, have been through a lot together, where women wept, where men died, and they are at ease in one another's company. Zondi laughs as Cramer jerks awake. Cramer feels curiously content at his sergeant's presence. The mission school reference establishes the poverty of Zondi's background, but also one of his exceptional intellectual abilities, his memory. A couple of pages later, another of Zondi's skills is on view. Cramer has searched, but can find no information in the cottage. Come through and have a look yourself, he invites Zondi. Again, I'm quoting, before Zondi had joined the force, he had spent a year as a houseboy. This had given him an eye for the details of a white man's abode, which was as fresh and perceptive as that of an anthropologist, making much of what the natives themselves never noticed. Cramer had found it invaluable more than once. And again, in this instance, it's Zondi's ability to read the contents of the rubbish tin in the kitchen that turns up a vital piece of evidence. Zondi also has finely honed local knowledge. He recognizes a grain of sorghum found in a suspect's car, and he drives Cramer to an old experimental farm. This hybrid was distinctive. No wonder the peasant farmer's son had so readily recognized the sample caught in the Dodger's substructure. Unquote. Another advantage that Zondi has is his ability to interview Zulu speakers, making the most of a shared language and culture. He's particularly adept at winkling crucial details out of servants. And as Cramer notes, servants can tell you more about a family than their own doctor, lawyer, and abortionist rolled into one. In this book, as in the entire series, we see the two policemen working closely together, sharing information and opinions, and it is clear that Cramer depends on and admires, I want to make that point, admires Zondi's skills. And so working together across the series, Cramer and Zondi develop a close, even warm relationship. In book after book, there is a moment like this from the Caterpillar Cop. Quote, then they laughed together, as they often did on their own, when on their own. Or in Snake, quote, then they laughed together as they often did when first meeting up, unquote. Their relationship, in fact, is a surreptitious friendship disguised as a business-like partnership and coded by apartheid norms. Here are two policemen who work well together, who appreciate each other's abilities, so much so that their personal closeness and their professional relationship and their mutual respect all run counter to the everyday norms and expectations of a racist society. And so the pair go to considerable lengths to conceal the nature of their teamwork. Time and again, in front of other policemen, Cramer takes pains to disguise his reliance on Zondi. In The Gooseberry Fool, Zondi is shot and taken to hospital. Cramer says that he will look in on him, and another white policeman asks, but what for? Hell, I don't know, he replied with a lie and a laugh. I suppose just to see how much damage there is. Maybe I'll have to get myself a new boy. Unquote. And in public, He addresses Zondi rudely and in extreme racist terms. He also speaks disparagingly about him as though he were not there. Zondi, for his part, plays the role of deferential subordinate. In front of other policemen, he slouches and mutters. He walks behind Kramer, never alongside him. They also put racial stereotypes to work as a form of concealment. At one stage in the steam pig, the pair are being held at gunpoint. And, I'm quoting, Kramer and Zondi slipped whimsically into their old routine of electrician and electrician's mate, an act perfected in dozens of unsuspecting homes. Within seconds, the illusion was complete, right down to the feeling that the black man, obsequiously responding to gruff respects for tools, I'm a screwdriver, within easy reach, could have done the job much better himself. The relationship between the two men and its concealment are central to these novels. Let me return to the steam pig. There's an initial puzzle in that a young white woman has been murdered with a weapon normally associated with criminal gangs in Johannesburg's townships, the bicycle spoke. And the more Kramer probes into the background of the young music teacher, the less he has to go on, the fewer traces of her life she seems to have left behind. The breakthrough comes when an unknown, older woman visits the mortuary asking questions about Teresa LaRue. Kramer follows her to the bus station, but then unaccountably loses sight of her. She appears to have vanished. Is she hiding in one of the woman's lavatories? Kramer gets a woman colleague to help him and establishes, no, she is not. And then, quote, a little old lady was making her way from the entrance marked non-white females. She walked unsteadily, tacking into the breeze which bellied out her black dress and made the sad roses bob on her hat. It swiftly follows that Mrs. Francis is the dead woman's mother, and that when her late husband had been taken to hospital with TB, the authorities had reclassified him as coloured. She and her two children were also redesignated no longer white, but coloured. And this is the crux of the entire story. We discover with Kramer and Zondi what the consequences were of this distinctively South African piece of bureaucracy. How Teresa successfully passed for white, and why this made her vulnerable, and how her younger brother's life fell apart. Again, McClure makes no comment on the vileness of the race classification project. Readers are left to draw their own conclusions and to make their own moral judgments on apartheid. One of the things that makes this such a satisfying read, and I think an impressively confident first novel, is the way McClure combines a tightly plotted, fast-moving crime story with a wry humor and this oblique, ironic political commentary. Let me give a couple of examples of this technique. In The Gooseberry Fool, Zondi has been sent on his own to Northern Natal to look for an absconded servant who may have killed his employer. He approaches the village on foot, and now a longish quote. He saw Roberts Holt, the name of the village, he saw Roberts Holt across the river, and a sight quite extraordinary. The place was surrounded by policemen, the whites armed with Sten guns and the Africans with spears. There must have been sudden dramatic developments in the case that he was unaware of. As he continued walking towards the hamlet, his mind struggled with conjecture, tried to think what possible reason there could be for such a turnout. Even if Shabalala had taken a gun from Swart's home and was expected to resist arrest, 6 men at most would have been sufficient for the job. There was the sound of an engine starting up, and then came a truck piled high with villagers and their property. What an idiot he had been. It was an eviction, an ordinary black spot eviction, one of hundreds, an everyday event, and he had allowed his imagination to distort his vision. Unquote. Again, neither McClure nor Zondi makes any critical or disapproving remark about forced removals. These would be redundant. Zondi then travels 150 kilometers further inland to where the community has been removed, to a desolate site called Jabula, or Happiness, or Bier. And on foot again, Zondi makes the descent down to Jabula on the plain below. I'm quoting again. He saw there were, in fact, very many people resident in Jabula, at a guess well over 300, with the only males being either the very old or the very young. He had not spotted the inhabitants before because they were seated in the shade of their homes, silent, motionless in different attitudes. His immediate reaction was instinctive, a prickling across the spine, a tightening of sinew that halted him in his tracks. And then he realized there was nothing ominous in this, for not a head turned to inspect him. These were people lost in themselves and totally listless. He had once seen something of the kind after a whirlwind flattened a township near Kokstad, but that had nothing to do with anything. Unquote. Again, the critique of forced removals is inferred, not insisted upon. And this is typical of McClure's technique. One admiring reviewer wrote that the history lesson is never intrusive, makes it the more effective. McClure usually avoided explicit reference to politics. The main exceptions to this description occur in the last two novels he wrote. His penultimate novel, The Artful Egg, weaves together two investigations: the stabbing of a local novelist, Naomi Stride, and the death of a retired policeman's wife in their family shower. We learn that the ex-policeman had worked for the special branch, where he was known as Major Many Slip Zelemeyer, and that, quote, his basic problem had been a lot of bad luck with prisoners. Two political detainees in his charge had jumped out of the same 10-story window in security branch headquarters, and no fewer than three others had slipped on the soap while taking showers under his supervision. Unquote. Was it a domestic accident? Was it really bad luck for Major Zedemeyer, or murder? A slightly far-fetched plotline reveals that it was murder, but that the Major was the intended victim, that his killer was seeking, or his would-be killer, was seeking a form of retribution for the Major's special branch past. The second plotline is even more far-fetched. The novelist had been stabbed with a theatrical sword, the murderer left a trail of Hamlet-linked clues. It all looked like a very literary killing, but in fact, turns out, I do hope you finished it, turns out to have been committed by embittered white Rhodesian right-wingers, hostile to Naomi Stride's liberal politics. Another atypically explicit political comment is worth noting, and this comes in Song Dog, published in 1991, the final Cramer and Zondi novel, but written as a prequel, set in 1962, and it's the backstory to Cramer and Zondi. Cramer has just arrived in Natal from the Free State, and he hates it. He and Zondi are on separate cases, both in northern Zululand. They don't yet know each other. Zondi undercover on the track of a black killer, Cramer to investigate an explosion which has killed two whites. Their cases eventually intersect, the pair meet, they exchange information, and on their first encounter, after racial banter, quote, they both laughed as though they had just invented a new kind of joke together, unquote. So he uses that idea quite frequently. At this meeting, Zondi explains that Kramer has been called in to assist because the local station commander is away, quote, assisting the security branch to find a certain Bantu male, Nelson Mandela. Who? Asked Kramer. Oh, Santosa, says Zondi, with what seemed a very Zulu gesture of dismissal for someone belonging to a lesser tribe. I seem to remember that he's also ANC, once a lawyer. Unquote. The function of that passage, and that's all there is, the function of that passage, though, is to set up the very ending of the book, which is also the end of the series. Zondi is repeating to Kramer details that he's been told by the Sangoma that he, as white policemen have also in the novel, has been to consult. A rather rider haggardish old woman Sangoma up in the hills. And Zondi is repeating things told to him by the Sangoma's familiar, the Song Dog. The Song Dog said we must beware of the wife of the prisoner, Mandela, who was captured this week, Lieutenant. Hey, what nonsense is that? We haven't taken any bloody prisoners. What else? Oh, the Song Dog also wondered that one far-off night, Lieutenant, you and me would stand alone together, arm in arm in a black township, wearing red necklaces as bright as petrol flames, on the orders of the self-same. Necklaces, said Kramer. You and me? Us? Who ever heard of blokes in bloody necklaces? What the hell do they take us for, hey? A couple of bloody Nancy boys and poofters? Zondi laughed and swung his door open, cocking Kramer's pistol. You're right, my boss, he said. It's bad enough that the lieutenant and me go picking the wild, wild flowers now. Unquote. Picking the wild flowers, and he using Kramer's pistol, he's going to execute a black murderer, and they're going to use Kramer's pistol to make it look as though Kramer had done it. But that's just explaining that otherwise impenetrable white brass line. I think the Clears worked quite hard at that ending. After all, this is his eighth novel, bringing the whole series to close. I personally find it a discomforting close to the book and the series. I find it clunky and artificial in its mix of the supernatural and the political. And how exactly are we expected to read it? Is it an unintentional expression of white fears of the other in the ferment that was the early 1990s? Or is it an altogether darker political message, somewhat at variance with the rest of the books, that Kramer and Zondi, despite their personal likability, have all along been on the wrong side of history as agents of the apartheid state, doomed therefore to die? Before examining the politics of the Kramer and Zondi books more closely, a couple of comments on how they were written and how they were received. An American scholar judges them as perhaps the finest series featuring post-colonial detectives. He also remarks that McClure was forced to leave because of his opposition to the apartheid government, that the books, quote, were immensely popular in South Africa, although they were not legally sold there, unquote. And leaving aside his judgment on the series, he likes them, what I find striking about this passage is that all its facts are wrong. McClure left South Africa because he found it compromising to live there. 30 years later, he told an interviewer, I couldn't see how you could live there and not be party to apartheid. You couldn't be white and not be part of the boot. I just found it less and less bearable. Unquote. He told me that he had a young child whom he wanted to relocate in the United Kingdom. So he left because of apartheid, yes, but of his own volition, and certainly not as some kind of anti-apartheid activist. What about the alleged popularity of the series in South Africa and their illegal status, bunk and nonsense, respectively? We know the answer to this, as Richard Peck has examined the reception of these books in South Africa. Writing in the mid-1990s, he, Peck, was struck by McClure's popularity in the US and UK, and by the fact that the books, quote, appear to have disappeared with hardly a trace in South Africa itself. So he looked into this. He discovered that they had been reviewed when they originally appeared only in the Natal newspapers, in the Witness and the Daily News, and that they never acquired a significant readership. And he concludes, and I'm quoting, "While I have no smoking gun to show, suspicions suggest that South African mass market readers stay away from McClure for the same reasons they turn to Wilbur Smith. Wilbur Smith is a more comfortable read, and McClure raises too much unease in most South African mass market readers." Unquote. Now, they've all been reissued. You can, and they're popping up in second-hand bookshops and on crime fiction shelves in South Africa. But that's a pretty recent phenomenon. McClure himself explained that he wanted to do something different from the conventional anti-apartheid stance of many novels about South Africa. Quote, "Most of all, I welcomed the neutrality of the crime story. Crime or mystery novels appeal to pretty well everyone, including the more conservative, if not downright reactionary reader." Unquote. "Readers were left," said McClure, "left to make their own moral judgments, while the point of the tale remained whodunit." He insisted he was writing for entertainment. He made another point about his choice of the format, the police procedural. Quote, "But it was also because police have access to every level of society. You can move between all the levels in one book. You couldn't do this as easily in a novel." Unquote. It's exactly the same benefit of the police novel as that identified by Rankin. So let me return to the politics of these books. They were clearly hostile to apartheid. "It was anger, chiefly, that made these books," said McClure in 1994, "and some sense of wanting to convey to as many people as possible what something was like." Many reviewers have concentrated on this single aspect of the political positioning of the books, that they were critical of apartheid. They were, says an American reviewer, "a grotesquely vivid picture of life under apartheid." Another, "a damning condemnation of apartheid." And quote, thirdly, "a picture of apartheid that will teach American readers a good deal about how South Africans think and operate." I shudder to think what Americans would make of South Africa based on these novels. But anyway, all of that, I mean, that they're anti-apartheid, yes, but what is the content of the critique? What are its political implications, and what alternatives are on offer? And there have been a couple of attempts to provide answers to these questions. Firstly, somebody called Ed Tomarken has argued that the Kramer-Zondi relationship suggests how whites and blacks can maintain their difference from one another while working together for the improvement of South African culture. And for Tomarken, McClure believes that the hope for a peaceful end to apartheid is something for the Afrikaner and black to work out. Their relationship, he believes, is a microcosm of South African culture, where black and white cultures overlap without loss of difference. What the two policemen illustrate is, quote, that distinction remains but requires cooperation, collaboration respects rather than erases difference. Now, I find that a totally unconvincing account of the political thrust of these novels. The concern to maintain difference seems to me to be Tomarken's preoccupation and not McClure's. Secondly, and far more convincingly, Winston and Melesky, their book on the police procedure is on the handout. They argue that the Kramer and Zondi series, with its white and black detective team, articulates the liberal hope for slow and evolutionary change, unquote, as opposed to more radical strategies. By narrowing the police novel down to a two-man team, McClure operates with a purely personalized, hopeful vision of individual cooperation. They go on to say that his approach marginalizes any form of collective black action against the apartheid system, omitting any real sense of black people in their collectivity as agents of their own history. I've already mentioned the necklace reference that concludes Songdog. In The Artful Egg, Zondi refers in passing to what happened in Soweto. And he says, with children, it is always the same. They are too impatient. And they must tell me, this is his kids, they must tell me if they hear of agitators, because those men are very foolish. All police procedurals, all police novels, have central figures who stand in a particular relationship to society. They, because they are policemen, they are agents of social control. They are part of the state apparatus enforcing law and order. And in many books, as I said at the beginning, this gives the police procedural an essentially conservative function. It reassures readers that there is protection against lawlessness and disorder. The discipline and the cooperation in the police team is just one cog in a larger machinery of social discipline and cooperation. But in the case of McClure's crime novels, as you've seen, the issue is more complicated. McClure is critical of the legal and social order of apartheid, and yet it is this legal and social order that Kramer and Zondi serve. Time and again in the novels, it's made clear that Zondi is feared and resented by his black compatriots. Children scatter when he comes into the township. Kramer, for all his humane qualities, retains the prejudices and racial attitudes of his time. Both men are agents of the apartheid state. And as Elizabeth Fletcher has written of the steam pig, quote, in terms of its ideology, the novel's world, its status quo, is distinctly that of its white, male, conservative protagonist, Tromp Kramer. Winston and Melesky were writing in 1992, and they ended their chapter with these words. The real potential for generalized black violence, which constitutes a fact of life in present-day South Africa and a possibility for its future, is thus defused in the odd couple of Kramer and Zondi, the eccentric Boer seconded by a conservative African, himself co-opted into the collaborating elite. For South African readers, they argue, this agenda offers a reassuring and apparently hopeful vision of accommodation. And I think this is a fair assessment of McClure's politics, a cautious liberalism, with Kramer and Zondi a theoretical embodiment, a personification of a possible reconciliation. They are meant to represent a more hopeful vision of racial harmony. But at the same time, these novels don't tackle some of the more challenging aspects of the period at the time they were written. And I think one could fairly compare them in this respect, just how they situated politically, with the novels of Wessels Ebbesson, featuring his investigator, the Jewish prison psychiatrist Yudel Gordon. He wrote three of these, writing more or less as the McClure series ends, Emerson's novels are published between 1979 and 1990. They are grueling psychological thrillers, exposing the reality of the security police and exploring the nature of evil. Each book is set very, very specifically at a particular moment in the final throes of apartheid. They chart the demise of the apartheid system, revealing the moral perversities attendant on that process and analysing the fears and anxieties in white, but especially Afrikaner society. As well as those three books, Emerson also wrote Store Up the Anger, based loosely but clearly on Steve Biko's life and death. In fact, all of his books are fictionalized accounts of real events. You can identify specific cabinet ministers and policemen, etc., from his books. His novels develop a sustained critique of the ideology and criminal activities of the special branch. They are explicitly and politically confrontational. They put me in mind of Per Waerlouw's metaphor of the crime novel as a scalpel cutting into an analysis of a society. In sharp contrast, the critique in the Karma and Zondi novels is largely implicit, oblique, and the politics is downplayed. Exactly a decade ago, a critic writing on Wessel Ebbesson commented, quote, "Detective fiction has rarely been considered a major genre in South African literature," unquote, and he noted how few writers had turned to the genre during the apartheid era. Was a woman called June Drummond, writing from London. She's sometimes regarded as really the pioneer of the crime story in South Africa. But McClure and Ebbesson are probably the only significant authors of crime fiction writing during the apartheid era. In post-apartheid South Africa, the picture is quite dramatically different, and that is the topic of tomorrow's lecture. Thank you very much. Sorry, just a little bit hubbub die. Leaving aside the warmth of the relationship and the friendship and all of that, McClure based Kramer and Zondi on actual Afrikaner and Zulu policemen working in pairs in Maritzburg. So that part is perfectly faithful. Whether that's peculiar to Natal, I have absolutely no idea. I've always taken it as a given that policing threw up that sort of relationship, particularly with the hierarchy involved, lieutenant or inspector, and constable or sergeant. Yeah. At the very back? No, McClure died in the 1990s, I think, or perhaps more recently. He died when? 2006, yeah. He died in 2006. It's not relevant to the lecture at all, but I will mention it, that the year before I went to Oxford, I worked as a journalist in Maritzburg, in the Maritzburg Bureau of the Natal Daily News, the Zulu newspaper. When I first moved in with my track record, I thought, oh, you're in Jim McClure's seat. McClure used to work there. Then, some years later, I had the CP in Oxford, in England. Absolutely a chance. I even read his non-fiction book on the
least in Liverpool was sacked. And I came back to Oxford in the early 1980s and discovered that Jim McKeown was editing the Oxford Times. So I met him there and saw him only a couple of times. But it was quite a nice link for me.
They
were sold in South Africa, but that doesn't keep out there being reading it such wrong. They were published by Alex, there's also a paperback version, I forgot which one it is. Gertrude says that he used to tell him that Wesley's, the magnets in Maritzburg, sold them because the special branch policemen bought them like we did.
Yeah. Do not think she's very similar to him.
In what you said?
In the same kind of setting, the first one especially.
Yeah.
I felt that she sort of almost took from him.
Yeah, she's, I'm really asked about South African life now based in Australia called Marlon Nunn. I'm going to refer briefly to her work tomorrow, but they are set in the 1960s, 1950s and 60s, her crime novels. She's more writerly than McKeown. She's not as light, light-footed as he is. But I observe how much directly he is to do with something else. Anyone else? Yes.
Did
McKeown
write all these books while in exile, out of South Africa?
Yeah, with them all
sitting in England. He didn't come back
to check. No, he didn't come back until 1989.
Indeed, see you tomorrow.
Well, it doesn't. Does it reflect this sort of, oh gosh, crime is much more crime off the borough? Is it part of that?
What they offer is that somebody somewhere is arresting criminals.
Do you know Michael White? He was a journalist. I think he's a
journalist. That name doesn't mean about it.
When you say the books weren't that successful in South Africa, and of course the point of the fact that the newspapers didn't bother to review them is a telling point. But nevertheless, I mean, South Africa as a reading public isn't really big enough to have an impact on what you might call the popularity of a particular book. I mean, what other books would have taken off in South Africa?
I mean, I would make this comparison. He was much more popular, much more widely read in the UK and US than he was in South Africa. Dion Meyer, he's published in 19 languages, but sells wildly here.
Well, Lenny Gordon was read in South Africa. Or very relatively.
That's a higher brow literature, yeah. Right.
Okay, thanks.
I wanted to ask you about yesterday's lecture, when you were talking about the detective novels reflecting society. Mm. And I was just wondering whether you thought that they reflected society more or less than others. Because you sort of, you know, said it in a surprised way.
Do you mean more than other genres?
Yeah.
Probably not. I think probably more than romantic literature. Because they are dealing with not only life and death issues, but right and wrong issues, I think they probably do say more about any given society. You can find out a fantastic amount about South African society by reading contemporary crime novels.
Mm-hmm.
You could write a good PhD thesis on crime from the detective stories.
Because I'm just thinking in the case of Oxford, with people writing about Oxford in a more diverse way,
yeah.
I think perhaps that's more surprising because of the sort of theme or the symbol of Oxford as this nostalgic, unchanging, timeless.
And I think that's what strikes me. Although they write about it in very different ways, there's a very strong kind of common theme to the Oxford detective fiction, which is Oxford as nostalgia.
Mm.
The great good place sullied by crime and then put right by whomever it is.
But do you think that because a lot of the authors were at Oxford, do you think that that is a sense of change over time for them, looking back to presumably it wasn't that far ago that they were there, or do you think that it's that they're more sort of exploring a myth of timelessness from the outside or a tourist view?
I think most of them were there when they were 18 to 21.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So